So what I do is I give the instruction to consider one at a time. What if God is nothing? What if all you people are delusional that are talking about God? What if that little voice in the back of my mind is right when it says, don't believe this stuff? It's a fair question, right? When somebody tells me they never have that question, I usually don't believe them, right? There's the people that are solid believers that will ramble on about God. But if you can underline enough here that if you could underline enough here where you don't rely on God, that means that you're relying more on yourself, so that element of doubt is still there. Your belief is blinding you from it. Because if you really believed, then you wouldn't be underlining anything. Right? So I give them the instructions to sit with, depending on the person. Some people can take it a little more than others. Some people need it longer than others. Some people can't take it long at all. But the idea is, what if there is no God? And sit with that for a week. Stop praying. Stop doing anything spiritual. I already see some people shaking their heads. Right? And it's like, and the response to that is, yes, I know it's scary for some. Right? But first of all, God's not going to punish you for doing any kind of exercise that's going to get you closer to Him. Right? Secondly, right? You ignore God all day anyway, most of the time. So what's the difference? Right? Just be honest and admit it. Right? And we'll get into more of that in 10 and 11. But so you usually go through the day ignoring God anyway. Right? Just acknowledge it. Live that way and acknowledge it. Sit with it for a week. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll have them actually do 5 days, because when I work with someone, I meet once a week, same time, same day, every week. I make that commitment to them. And so I give them, I tell them to call me 2 days before we get together, or sooner if they have to, and just sit with the idea of, what if there is no God? And I ask them to stop, as I said, stop doing any prayer, but I ask them to do one meditation. And they could do it more than once if they like. And to go back and use page 52, right? And ask those questions in the middle of 52. Like, what if that little voice in the back of my head is true? That there really is no God. No more power for me than what I can muster up on my own. What would that look like in my personal relationships? If there really was no more for me than what I've ever had without God. Just me on my own power. My love relationships. Right? My family relationships. Work relationships. Friend relationships. Right? What if I had if there was nothing more for me than just me on my own power? What about my emotional natures? What if there really was no God, nothing that would help me or take me beyond that place those emotions that are going on inside of me? Again, I know I keep repeating it, they're not necessarily the emotions the face you see, but the emotions that are going on underneath that. What if I had no power to live by that would take me to any better place? What if that little voice in the back of my head that says there is no God, that leaves me in that alone place where it's just me, how would that look like when I'm prey to misery and depression? Alone in my home, just feeling in that swamp of self-pity. Right? with no power to get out of that on my own. Feelings of uselessness. Couldn't make a living. Completely dissatisfied with my life. What if there is nothing more for me than what I've been operating on my own power? When I consider my dissatisfaction with any life that I've had. Feelings of uselessness. The fears, the unhappiness. What if that little voice in the back of my head says there isn't a God that's going to really work in my life? What if I'm right? And we sit with that, and I ask them to review the page 52 at least once a day. To live like there is nothing more for them. Right? And it's not an easy meditation for some. When we first started playing with that meditation, a friend of mine put somebody on it for 3 weeks. Wasn't a good idea. Trust me, I won't go into the specifics, but so just before we get together, I asked them to consider the other question. What if God is everything? What if there is a God? Right? What if that little voice in my mind that's always not believed has always been wrong? And there is a God that can move me beyond all of my problems. Right? That can take me further in my life than anything I've ever had. Right? How would that look like in my relationships? If I could tap into more power than I've ever known how to use. What would that look like in my emotional nature? Right? If all my fight and arguments and my prejudice against spiritual way of life, what if it was all wrong and I just never learned how to approach it? Right? And I had more power to go into life situations like misery and depression. What if I could identify that and actually tap into something that could get me up out of my house and maybe to a meeting or something, or just to answer the phone, right? Because it doesn't usually take that much to get out of that place. Right? Because my problems are always spiritual. Right? Either God is everything, or I'm everything. Either God is all there is, or I'm all there is. There's no middle ground here. Right? It has to give me an absolute, otherwise I'll take the middle road every time just to not make a decision. Right? But most of us live on our own power most of the time. And I don't know that that's, and I believe that that is actually a God-given ability. Right? But there's more to talk about with that later on. It confuses me because I want to figure situations out. I want to drive through these situations. I want to work on my problems. Right? But I have to see by my past experience where that got me. Right? And it's my past experience that should give me the desperation that I need to lean towards this idea that maybe there's something that I don't know about this. Maybe there's something more for me than I've ever used, right? And all my resistance towards this God thing, maybe it hasn't been necessary. Maybe there is more for me than I've ever had, right? Am I willing to believe that? Absolutely, right? Because the alternative, right, that I'm all there is, means that nothing's going to change, that nothing can change for me. Okay. Time. So, which leads us into step three, which is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, there's a requirement before making that decision. But before that requirement, I want to touch on this. There's the ABCs that I have to be convinced of. A, that I'm an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. And B, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. And I certainly tried human power to relieve my alcoholism. Therapy, friends, myself. Right? And nothing saved me from that. But the harder one was that God could and would if he were sought. Right? Because I still don't know what God is. I still don't understand how that's going to work. Right? But the truth about my condition keeps pushing me forward anyway. Because I have to believe that there's something more for me. Otherwise, I'm dead. Right? And I don't look at all the way through up through the sixth step. I don't really talk a lot about God. Even though the book talks about God, but I look at more my agnosticism and my resistance to that. Right? And even in step three, it talks about this being a decision. Right? Just a decision to do what it's going to take to get me to God. But before that, there's this first requirement. First requirement is that we be convinced. And this is on 60 if you're trying to follow along. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. And another great exercise here in step three is to go back through page 52 and look at those questions in regards to self-will. How good is self-will done in regards to my relationships? Right? How well has self-will gotten me to get out of poor emotional conditions, emotional natures, or misery and depression? Right? Any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. Right? I have to be convinced of that. But I think more than anything, it's pivotal here because step one is pivotal because I have to be clear on step one why I need step three. Because if I get to step three unable to make this decision, right, towards needing to do the things to get me to this power, the problem is not step three. Right? If I can't make this decision in step three, that maybe the problem's step two. That I never really believed that I needed a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. But if that's true, then the problem couldn't be step two either. It has to be step one. Right? Because maybe I'm not clear that I will drink again. And to drink for me is to die. So let me look at the time. Okay. On the bottom of page 60, I like to read this part in first person. And I think it's helpful to put it in, to personalize it for me. Dan is like the actor who wants to run the whole show. Dan is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in Dan's way, right? In other words, I want all you lined up like this, right? I had the podium in the middle. It was on the side at the beginning. And set everything up just how Dan needed it, right? If Dan's arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as Dan wished, then the show would be great. I like this particular sentence, a couple sentences actually. If Dan's arrangements in his marriage would have only stayed put, if only she would have done, my wife would have done as I wished, then the marriage would have been great. Right? Everybody, including me, especially me, would have been pleased. Life would have been wonderful. If Dan's arrangements at work would have only stayed put, if only those clients would have done as I wished, then work would have been great. We all would have been happy. Right? If Dan's arrangements at that meeting would only have stayed put, if only you people would say what I want you to say, then the meeting would be great. Right? We all would be happy if you were just saying what I wanted you to say. We would be pleased if life would. I'm sorry. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. Dan may be quite virtuous. Dan can be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. That's me, right? Right. It's the face I want you to see. On the other hand, Dan can be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. I know it's hard to believe, right? But I do have that side. But as with most humans, Dan is more likely to have varied traits. What usually happens? Dan's show doesn't come off very well. Dan begins to think life doesn't treat him right. Dan decides to exert himself more. Right? Exert more of what already hasn't worked, right? More self-will, more playing God. Dan becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play doesn't suit Dan. Admitting Dan may be somewhat at fault, Dan is sure that others are more to blame, right? You can relate to that, right? It's your fault my life isn't what it should be. Dan becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is Dan's basic trouble? Is there any people pleasers here? Right? Afraid to raise your hand, huh? Listen to what the book says. Isn't Dan really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? I don't please anybody unless there's something in it for me. Right? Because even people that think they're people pleasers are usually doing it because they want to manipulate a response from you. Right? Because if you don't give them the response they need, they just get pissed off. So much for people pleasing, right? Isn't Dan not a victim of the delusion that if he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world, if he only manages well? Now, rest is an interesting word. You see rest in other words, like wrestling, right? It's force, right? So I like to read it like that. Is not Dan a victim of the delusion that he can wrestle satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well? Right? I work really hard to try to get the things that I need out of the people around me and the things around me. Right? It is not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things that Dan wants. And do not Dan's actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Right? Too many directors here, I think. Too many people trying to run the show. Right? It doesn't work well when I'm trying to snatch what I need out of the world and from you, and you're trying to snatch what you need out of the world from me. Right? Is it not evident, even in his best moments? I'm sorry. Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Right. So here it's saying I'm a producer of confusion. So I'm the actor trying to be the director, who's also trying to be the producer. Right? or actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. Now, self-centered doesn't necessarily mean I think too well of myself. And it certainly doesn't mean I think too little of myself. What self-centered means to me is that all I think about is myself and what's in it for me. But from an agnostic perspective, right, how else am I going to get what I need? Right? I have to create and pull out of the world what I feel I need to be okay. Because I can't sit back and let nothing happen, because if I don't believe that there's a power that'll work in my life, then I have to be that power. Right. Skip to page 62. Selfishness and self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our trouble. Okay. That's just the first sentence of the paragraph. Right? But people hang on that. And if I say, what's your trouble? Oh, selfishness and self-centeredness. Right? Because that's what the book says. But it says that it's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And those are the things that we're going to look at in the fourth step. Specifically in the fourth column of the fourth step. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. What I have to see is, yes, it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. But if I had a plant and I pulled it out with roots and all and I set it on the table, right, it would die. Right? It could not live. Right? It has to be in fertile soil. And what the experience of the fourth step has to take me to is that agnosticism is the fertile soil that the roots of my trouble, my roots of my selfish, self-centered actions and attitudes thrive in that agnosticism. Right? That agnosticism is the fertile soil that my selfish, self-centered root of my trouble thrives in. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. So, that should give us hope that my troubles are basically of my own making. Right? Because if it really was all your guys' fault, the condition of my life, then you'd all have to change for me to be okay. Right, but if my troubles are basically all of my own making, right, then something just has to change in me. Right, and that's what we're hoping for here. Right. So that last paragraph on 62, the third step prayer is not the third step. It's an affirmation of the third step. You ever hear someone get up to the podium and say, I don't know how this program works or why it works? I don't know if they do that here, but I've heard it at home. Well, direct them to this paragraph. This is the how and the why of it. This is how it works and why it works. So how does it work? And this paragraph is the third step prayer. And we look at this paragraph, and then I send the people that I work with home to consider some questions in this paragraph. So here's how it works. First of all, we had to quit playing God. That's how it works. I have to quit playing God. Right? And why does that work? Because playing God didn't. Too simple, I know. How it works and why it works is I have to quit playing God, and why it works is because playing God didn't. And so then it says, next we decided. So here's the decision. Hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. So there's three relationships there: father, child, principal, agent, actor, director. Right. I turn those into questions, and I ask, and I, as I said, I sent the people I work with home for a week to consider them, right? Because it's going to mention in this, the next page, that we thought well before taking this step. And the first question is that regarding the actor and director. How good a job have I done directing my life up to this point? Right. Well, based on what I've seen in the first three steps, it's not too hard, not very hard to answer, is it? Okay. I've also heard people say they take the third step, they did the third step and they took it back, take the third step and took it back. What part of I didn't direct my life too well do you want to take back? There's really not much to take back there. When I look at my experience and acknowledge that I didn't do a very good job because my great direction ended me up at, right here in AA. The next question that I ask them to consider is the principal and agent. Principal has a fiduciary responsibility to be who the... I'm sorry, I got that backwards. The agent has a fiduciary responsibility to be who the principal would have them be. Right? In other words, if I am the principal and you're my agents, and you're supposed to be who I need you to be. So if I'm standing here and I'm the principal, how good a job have I done making you be who I need you to be? How good a job have I done making me who I would have me be? Right. Either you're not listening to me because you're not doing, you're not being who I would have you be, right? Or whatever, I don't know. Bottom line is I can't make the world around me change. I can't make you be who I need you to be, to fix me, to give me what I need. I can't even be who I need me to be. Right? When I look at myself, and I can be most critical of myself more than anybody. I can't make myself who I would have me be on my own power, by myself, without this program, without God. And then the third question is the father and child relationship. In Freudian psychology, the father is the provider. And that kind of goes along with what it says on the next page. It says, the father provides what the child needs. So the question here would be, how good a job have I done providing what I need on my own power? Just me on my own power, without God, without this program, just me alone. Right. So I consider that, those three things. How good a job have I done directing my life? How good a job have I done making you be who I would have me be? And how good a job have I done relying on myself, providing what I need on my own power? And then I look at the other side. You know, what would a reliance on God look like to direct my life? You know, what would it look like if I would just be who God would have me be? What about if I trust that God will provide what I need if I turn to Him? I look at both sides and then to make this decision. Right? And it's based on the truth about the way I've lived up to this point, and there's nothing to take back here. Right? So our time is up, but I think that this is important stuff, and I'll come back and finish this up. This is sort of where I stop when I'm working with people. Anyway, right? So it'll give you something to think about until we get back together. How good a job have you done directing your life? How good a job have you done making others be who you would have them be? And how good a job have you done providing what you need on your own power? Right? The decision to turn to God and to do the things that are going to get me to this understanding of how to access and direct that power, you know, are going to be based on this. Is me quit play, me stopping playing God. Right? There's only room for one of us. All right, thanks. So we'll come back at 10:30. Thank you. in my relationship, right? Seeing how I play God in my relationships and God in my own life, right? Because I got to get to this place where I see that playing God doesn't work. It says on the bottom of 62, it says, most good ideas are simple, right? I've made it pretty simple, right? Breaking it down into those three questions makes the third step pretty simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. Because we're building this spiritual arch. I pointed out the base of that arch is the powerful cement which binds us that it talks about on page 17. The cornerstone of our willingness to believe that there is a God that would work in our life. Right? And now it's talking about this concept as being the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Now, I look at a concept like a concept car. It isn't necessarily a car that you can go out and buy, but it might be a car that you can get in the future. Right? It's a vision of what a car could possibly look like. Well, they're talking about the concept of a spiritual way of life. Not necessarily one that I have, right? But one that hopefully I could have in the future. And a keystone is like the center stone in an arch, in a stone arch, right? And it supports all the weight of the arch, all the stones that are on each side of it. And I like to picture this arch over a doorway. And we're going to walk through that doorway into this new way of life. And the way we do that is by working the rest of the steps. And that's the process of walking through this arch to this new way of life. At this point, I like to jump ahead, and it's really the only place in the book that I do jump ahead, except for in step one when we go to page 52. But I like to look at what is that vision, what is that concept of that new way of life look like? And go to page 87. The bottom of page 87 in the 11th step, this is my spiritual practice. This is my spiritual way of life. As I go through the day, I'll pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. It's because I trust that God will provide what I need if I turn to Him. In the third step, it's just a decision. In the 11th step, it's a practice. It's part of my spiritual practice. Pausing through the day and turning to God. I constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show. Right? God's directing my life now. In the third step, it's just a decision. In the 11th step, it's a way of life. It's a practice. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, Thy will be done. What would God have me be? To you? To myself? Right? That's the principal and agent relationship. Again, it's just a decision in the third step. But that's this concept of this new way to live, and that's what I'm deciding into. So, the bottom of 63 is where the fourth step starts. It says, next we launched out in a course of vigorous action. Now, look at the words it's using here. Launched out. Vigorous action. All right? The first step of which is a personal house cleaning. That kind of suggests that we're supposed to jump into this thing. One of the things that you're going to understand probably at a little deeper level, certainly the first three steps. We're designed to keep taking you down another notch that self-reliance can't work, that I need to find this reliance in a power greater than myself. Well, now the four steps going to lay out this blueprint of my life run on self-will and what that looks like. So it's going to take me down some more notches, you know, chip away at some more of the idea that Dan doesn't need God. And again, this is not about me feeling good. It's going to tell me why I write inventory. On the next page, on 64, where it says, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, this is the top paragraph, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. And that's a great prayer. God, please help me face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from you, other people, and myself. I just wanted to mention this. I know that a lot of people are taking notes. I have all my notes written down in a guidebook. And if there's any interest in that, it's easy to get. And also, I'm going to be talking about the four step. And it could start to feel like a math class, right? Starting to talk about, because I get really into the how each part relates to each part, and you might walk out of here blinking your eyes crazily. I don't know. But I have actually, if you go to this to the internet, you can actually download some examples of this. There's no charge for it. Just if you type in this URL, if you go to bigbookawakening.com/step4.pdf, it should open right up for you if you've got a Adobe Acrobat, which comes on most computers these days. Right? It should just pop open. Yeah, bigbookawakening.com. No spaces in between that. Slash, that's where the top leans to the right. Right? Then all lowercase, step, and then the number 4, dot PDF. And that's like a direct link to that one file. It'll just should pop right open for you or download into your computer, one of the two.
You brought some books. Are you going to have any extra or not?
I probably won't. I didn't bring very many. I just brought a couple.
Okay. And you can buy those online, too.
Yes, you can. Yeah. But basically, it walks you through at a deeper level all the things I'm talking about. So, okay, where are we? Now, a lot of people approach this thinking that the four steps are going to make you feel better, right? The better you feel, the less you need God. Let's be honest, right? Right. This would not be as effective if it makes you feel better. It doesn't mean that when you have God in your life that you're not going to feel good, right? But I go through this thing where, and I think it's somewhat normal, right? That it's desperation that gets me to God. And I say that over and over again because it was true in the beginning and it's true today. You know, it's the things that I feel the most desperate about that drive me back to that source of power. In fact, I want to read something, if I can find it. In There Is a Solution, page 25. Where it says, there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which this process requires for its successful consummation. Underline, almost none of us like. If you liked it, you're not going to be looking at things that are going to drive you to God. You're going to have to look at things and find the things that you find objectionable about your behavior. Right? And it's that behavior that you don't like about yourself that is going to get you to that power. Right? So I don't write inventory. I don't write inventory just to seek comfort. I write inventory to face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from God, other people, and myself. Okay. So, okay, let me see. I don't want to read it. I don't just want to read to you. I want to pick up the parts where I can just discuss with you the high points. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Right? A spiritual life that takes no regular inventory, you can go spiritually broke. Okay? Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. Spiritual inventory is a fact-finding, fact-facing process. It's an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. Right. One object is disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, right? Or to disclose where I fall short, to get rid of these promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he can't fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly, searching out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure, and being convinced that self manifested in various ways with what is what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. Common manifestations of self are selfishness, self-seeking, dishonesty, fear, the way I treat people in relationships, right? Sex. So it's important here to look at the idea is that I can't fool myself about the value of hanging on to these resentments. Right, holding a resentment towards somebody else is like me taking poison and hoping you die. Right, that person might not even know that I'm resentful at them. Right, the thing is that resentment separates me from a spiritual place. Anger completely blocks me off from being in a place of comfort. Right. At least the way I've been living it, or doing anger. You know, today I just look at anger as a vehicle to get closer to God. Right. So I can't fool myself about the value of hanging on to a resentment. Right? It says resentment is the number one offender. Not alcohol, it says resentment. Resentment, destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From resentment stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. Now, here's a really important point that it's talking about here. It says when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Right? And that's what we talked about in step one. The unmanageability of my spiritual condition sets up the condition conducive for the insanity, that mental obsessions to return, and the physical problem comes back. I drink again, and I lose control, and I get consequences in my life. Right? So here it's saying exactly that. If the spiritual malady is overcome, you're going to straighten out mentally and physically. If the spiritual malady is never overcome, well, then you won't. You won't straighten out mentally and physically. And I think that's a big part of a lot of the therapeutic parts of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it never gets into the spiritual side in some areas. And I have to see that this is a spiritual program and I have a spiritual solution. So in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. So, the first instruction that I give the people that I work with, and it's immediately after we say the third step prayer, before they leave, we start a list. And I send them home to make that list and to give it some thought. And I actually don't only work with people one-on-one. I also do a lot of groups, where a dozen people in a room or 20 people in a room. And one of the biggest problems was getting everybody through together. And I found that giving it to them in little pieces seemed to help in a number of different ways. If someone was dragging behind, it gave them time to catch up, because we're moving so slow through it. The other thing was, I found that a lot of people don't take responsibility for their own spiritual practice, their own spiritual growth. You give them the whole instructions, say, call me when you're done, and then you don't see them. You meet every week up until this point, and there's a momentum that builds, and if you give them a little piece at a time, that momentum keeps them moving forward. So I find it really helpful to do this a piece at a time. This is not the easiest inventory that I'm going to talk about today, but it's going to change your life if you try it. I can guarantee that. All right. So first I give them a list. I tell them to make a list of the people, principles, and institutions with whom they're angry at. Now, sometimes I work with guys that will come to me and say, well, not angry at anybody. I have no resentments. Right? And the people that come to my mind, you know, they're the tall, long hair, very self-driven, self-willed guys. Yeah, I'm not angry at anybody. And it's like, yes, because you're too selfish to give anybody that kind of credit or energy to be angry at them. Just make a list of the people who bother you. And then the list looks exactly the same as the next guy's, because they have tons of people that bother them, but they're not going to give them the enough energy to actually say, I'm resentful at you. Right? But they tend to be bothered by plenty of people. When I work one-on-one with people, I don't limit it. But when I'm doing a group, it has a large variation of people. Sometimes people that are new, sometimes people that have written inventory, sometimes people that have never written inventory. But I want to move them through as a group. So I tell them, pick the 20 to 30 grosser handicaps, is what I call, to pull a word out of the book, the grosser resentments. Because that way they at least learn how to do this, and they can continue to write inventory forever, because inventory is a spiritual tool. And it's not something that I ever necessarily am going to stop writing. And it's something that this inventory is something that I actually have gotten better at the more I've done it and the more I've taught it. So, and one of the important things about that is the better I am at seeing the truth about a situation and identifying the things that I need to see, and the quicker I get to the solution of that situation and the less time I spend in it. Or sometimes I don't even fall into it because I understand what's going on around me. Right? So there's an experience that has to happen from this that... that we'll talk about actually later in the 10th step. Because this is about learning basically how I can turn out of these things that are blocking me from God. Right? So I tell them to make a list. Just come back next week with it done. Then we talk about the second column. Now, the book never refers to actual columns. But there is this chart in the book, and people have picked up the word columns, and the cause of the resentment. And if you look in the book on page 65, it gives some examples, like his attention to my wife, told my wife, I'm sorry, I should start at the beginning. Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife, told my wife of my mistress. Brown may get my job at the office. Right? Those are... That's basically how I tell them to list them. One, Mr. Brown. A, his attention to my wife. B, told my wife of my mistress. C, Brown might get my job at the office. We got some paperwork here. Just want to see what kind of inventory I have. What I found really helpful, though, is to pray into that list and ask myself, what's underneath all of those resentments? What's really driving that resentment? And I used everything I've wrote down here to kind of get clear on it. If you start, just plenty of times you'll see someone that's, when they start putting names down, like their mother or father or husband or wife or boyfriend, where there'll be 20 causes of the resentment. The more causes to the resentment is the more I'm trying to validate to you my right to hang on to this resentment. Because the more I can list, the more I can list in my mind, then the more I have a right to be mad. Right? But remember what it said in the page before, it's just not to fool ourselves about the value of holding on to these resentments. I pray into that list and I ask myself, what am I really angry at here? Usually I could come up with one sentence that covers the whole list. Right? Because I will have them write a separate page on each one of those things they come up with. So it's to their benefit to come up with the bottom line here, right? And they'll end up writing a lot less in the long run. And I don't believe that the amount you write is necessarily more beneficial. It's not about how many you write. It's about getting clear. And it becomes an incredible spiritual exercise to look at all of these things that I'm angry about with you and just ask, what am I really angry at? What's underneath all of that? And just look at that. Right. So we take that list and I say come back with that done next week. Giving them a piece at a time, there's no reason why they can't have it done. I've had people with 100 resentments have it all done by the following week. So, and I've given people all the instructions and I don't see them for a year. Right? That's the difference. Okay? Then it affects my sex relations, self-esteem, all these things that are next to that stuff on the list here. Well, there's 7 things that are actually mentioned in this area of the book. That's self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. Right? Those are all things that are listed here. And see, the chart here only gives me the first 2 columns. Right? And it gives me some lists of what it affects next to it with fear bracketed alongside of it. But it doesn't tell me what those are. A lot of people look at this and say, this is the whole inventory. Right? And I've tried those checkbox inventories where you just check little boxes and say, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right? You know, and it felt really good that I finished it. But the trouble was, is nothing really changed. I had a lot of comfort because I felt like I accomplished finishing my 4-step, right? But nothing really changed in my attitude towards the people, towards the situation, right? The value of this done like I'm talking about here is makes up what Carl Jung says earlier on in the book, just jump out. On page 27, here's what Carl Jung told Roland Hazard. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena, meaning he saw them, he saw these spiritual experiences, but he couldn't explain why. Again, you know, doctors really aren't trained in spiritual situations and spiritual matters of the spirit. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. In other words, everything seems to change. Right? Now, here's what you're going to see in the inventory. In this third column, I'm going to look at my ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces in my life. That's what I'm going to see in this third column. Right? And in the fourth column, what I'm going to see is what it goes on to say. These things are suddenly cast to one side and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. That's what the fourth column is going to give me, a new set of conceptions and motives. Right? That if I practice this way of life, those will begin to dominate me rather than the things in the third column. That's what Carl Jung says our spiritual experience looks like. And they didn't know how to give it to us. Right? And we're going to talk about that right now. So, I look at this as just, as I said, the first two columns. So the next paragraph below this chart on 65 says, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Checkboxes didn't give me thoroughness and honesty. Right? Don't get me wrong. A lot of people use them, and it helps a lot of people. But it didn't take me to where something that took more consideration got me. As I said in the beginning, I had five sponsors in my first year. The first four gave me different types of inventories. I had a questionnaire that I answered the ones that I thought applied, and I ignored the ones that I figured didn't. Somebody else gave me an autobiographical pass through it where I wrote a bunch of stuff that I already knew. Again, it just looked like I was trying to validate my reasons to be resentful to the person that was going to read it. Never gave me any new attitude or new information. And I did the checkbox inventory, so I have personal experience with it. Right? Again, I felt really good that I finished my inventory, but no new attitude, no new conceptions, nothing that I needed to get to move on from here. Right? But then it goes on to say, is when we were finished, right, with the first two columns here, it says we considered it carefully. Right? So how can you consider something carefully? There's two ways. Once you can talk about it, that's one way. The second way is to write it down. And if you're going to read it to someone later, writing it down makes a lot of sense. So some of you might have heard of an extended third column, and that's the validation for the extended third column. Because next to these seven areas of self, we're going to write how they affect us. All right? So I have an example. Microphone. I'm going to write the notes, and then I'll come back here to explain them. Oh, maybe I could just move this closer.
With difficulty.
Uh-huh. Pardon me? No, I was going to move the board.
This board?
Yes, I'll move that
one.
Can everybody see that?
No.
Maybe a little, this edge over here.
There you go.
All right. Rough. All right. Here we go. Lori, my first wife, left me when I needed her most. I had just gotten, you know, I was still drinking, and it became convenient for her to move back in after I'd gotten sober, because she needed to make a change in where she was living, and she needed to, you know, it just, plus we thought we would see what would happen if we got back together and see if it would work again. Well, she moved in when I had about 3 months sober. At about 6 months sober, she moved out. So Lori left me when I needed her most. So here's another place that I found really helpful to give people pieces of it, because it can get a little overwhelming with this third column. So we're going to just do two things at a time, the self-esteem and pride. So I'll write that first. You know what? I'm just going to write the headings and talk about the rest. I'm not used to writing on a board, and it's just going to get worse as we get down to the bottom. Self-esteem. Now, in order to get some focus here, we've defined how we approach each part of it, and it holds me to a method. And I know some people don't like the word method or mechanics, or but it's a great teaching tool. Because what we're trying to learn is how to do this and to do it effectively. And what I found is taking it in bite-sized pieces will give us a focus that will keep it to the certain format that is proven more effective. So self-esteem is the role that I've assigned myself here. Who am I? Right? Remember, Bill, there's no... Between the third step and the fourth step, it doesn't change chapters. He's talking about the actor trying to be the director, right? Well, self-esteem is the role I've assigned myself here in my little play. And the role I've assigned myself here in the marriage was I'm the best husband she could get, right? You could say, well, I don't have high self-esteem. I didn't think I was the best husband she could get. But see, if I thought I was the worst husband that she could have had, then when she left, I would have been mad at myself. Right? Because I would have figured that she was going to leave anyway. But my self-esteem says nobody could leave me. Right? Now, notice in this chart here that it has fear bracketed alongside. Let me just put something bigger here to mark my page so I can go back to it. All right. So it's good to jump ahead to look at what the instruction is for the fears. It says, on bottom, last paragraph on 67, it says, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulty. Self-esteem and pride are not my difficulties. Those are the things that I need to get back. My difficulty is what I write down, how it affects me. How was my self-esteem affected? So, self-esteem was, I'm the best husband that she could get. Right? Or want. Right? So, to bracket my fear alongside of that, the difficulty that I have with self-esteem, right? I just look at what that statement that I just said, and it's like, well, maybe I wasn't. Maybe I wasn't good enough. Right? Maybe that was really the issue. That's my fear. Whereas I write next to self-esteem, I am the best husband she could get. The fear bracketed alongside of it was not good enough. All right. The second one here is pride. Pride is the role I've assigned Lori. The role I've assigned you and how you're supposed to look and interact with me, how you're supposed to see me, feel about me, right? Now, the role I've assigned her, Lori, in this marriage is that no one should think I'm not worth staying with, right? And the fear that I bracketed alongside that was worthless, right? If I'm not worth staying with, then that fear is that I'm worthless. Right? So I use what I'm writing here to give me the fear. I'm not just going into my head to get the fear. I'm using what I'm writing next to these to show me what my fears are. Right? So this is the role I've assigned me, and this is the role I've assigned Lori and how she's supposed to interact with me. The next two are... room. Ambition and security. Ambition is what I want out here. Security is what I need in here, right? So what did I want from Lori? I wanted to be loved, right? But my fear was that I wasn't. She left me when I needed her most, right? I wanted to be wanted. My fear was that I wasn't wanted, that not wanted. Right? That was my ambition. Now, the template for this is on that URL that I just shared with you before, the step 4 PDF, .pdf. And so if you wanted to look at this closer, you certainly can. And that also gives a bunch of examples. So that was at bigbookawakening.com/step4PDF, .pdf. Okay. So that's my ambition. It's what I want out here. And what I needed inside here is I need to be not abandoned to be okay. Right? So the fear here was that I was abandoned, the fear of being abandoned. So these two I've given the person I'm working with after they've, the week following this, I give them self-esteem and pride, go home and do them, and they come back. I give them ambition and security the next week, go home and finish them, or call me as soon as they're done and I'll give you the next instruction, however you want to work that, right? In a workshop, if they haven't finished this and you're explaining this, there isn't too much work for them to catch up, right? But workshops are good from this perspective, as you can manipulate them with the pressure from the group. Like, you don't want to keep the group back. You don't want to be the one that makes this thing die. You know. But people can be more accountable to a group than they will be for their own spiritual growth. So I found that to be really helpful. Not everybody needs that. Some are hungry enough to have it and be motivated. You know, it's helped some people that normally wouldn't finish an inventory get through one. But then there's the others that are impossible, but that's another story. But look at this. This is what I need inside. And to get what I need inside, Lori had to do certain things out here between us. In order for her to do certain things out here, she had to live up to the role that I've assigned her and how she's supposed to interact with me and the role I've assigned myself. And I send them home after explaining all this stuff, and they finish all those, and then I come back and I give them the following three: personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. You can see I'm not used to writing on one of these boards. Okay, I give them the last three. Send them after they've done ambition and security. I give them instructions for the last three: personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. Personal relationships are my deep-seated beliefs on how the relationship is supposed to look. Remember, I'm the director here. And I'm directing the show, and this is the way a relationship is supposed to look. And that comes from wherever, you know, the people and experiences that I've had growing up, the examples I've had in my life. I have these deep-seated beliefs of the way this relationship with Lori was supposed to look. So what came off the end of my pen was, wives never leave their husbands, no matter what they do. Right? And the fear was that I'd be alone. Then there were sex relations. And I look at sex relations because there's a complete separate sex inventory. So I look at sex relations from the perspective of what is a real man in this relationship. right? Because this is not about Lori. This is my inventory, not hers, right? So what is a man in this relationship? Real man commands the respect of their wife. Commands the respect of their wives. Right, men? The fear is that I'm not respected. Right? And then pocketbook. No one should disregard the value of my financial support. So the fear is not valued. Again, the fears come from what I write in the third column. The process shows me the fears. So let's look at this. In sex relations, this is what a real man is, and I'm putting that real man into this personal relationship with my wife. And this is the way that relationship is supposed to look like between that real man and this my wife, Lori. And in that relationship, there's certain things I need in here to be okay with what's going on. That's my security. And based on what I need in here, these are the things I want to happen between us while we're interacting. And in order to get that from her, I've assigned her a role in my little play here and me a role in my play. Right? So this is starting to pull me down into this place where I see that all of these fears that are bracketed alongside the difficulties that I've written are really... It's proving what it says on that paragraph in 62. This is selfishness and self-centeredness driven by 100 forms of fear. Right? And here's the fear. And we're going to look at some of the other stuff on the next part. So let me just check my timing here. 11:45. Okay. Any questions on this so far? I know, it feels like a math lecture. Again, doing this is how you learn it, not listening to someone talk about it. Question? The fear for sex relations? Sex relations was a real man commands the respect of their wife. So the fear is taken right out of what I wrote, not respected. See, if I didn't have that fear, I'd be neutral to the resentment. Okay. But we'll get back to that in the fears. So I get all this down. And then it takes me to this, we get to this part in the book that, the bottom of 66, where it says, we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. The key to the future would be pretty important to have, wouldn't it? We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really had really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, doesn't mean if it was true or not. It still hurt us. It still affected us. It had the power to kill because it separates me from a spiritual place. How long does it take for a resentment to separate you from a good place? Right? Not long, right? Boom, it's gone. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. So the key to my future is being at a place where I could master my resentments. Would that be a good place to be in? I think so. This was our course, so it's going to tell us how to do it. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. So if the key to my future is being able to see this. If this was the course I'm going to have to take, I have to understand what does it mean by they, like myself, are sick too. And the only thing I have to go on, really, and to keep some focus to this, is what I've written so far. So if Lori was sick like I am, that means that I would do the things that Lori does. So I go back to the first column and the cause of the resentment. She left me when I was just getting sober and needed her most. So I ask myself, how have I done the things in column one to the person in column two and or others? How have I done the things in column one to the person in column... I'm sorry, how have I done the things in column two to the person in column one or others? And not did I do, but how did I do them? Right? Because if I'm spiritually sick like she does, that means that I've done those things to her or other people. So I look at the statement that I wrote, that she left me when I was just getting sober and needed her most. And I see through my fears how worthless and unloved and unwanted and abandoned that made me feel. And I look back at my own experience and I ask, well, how did I do that to her? And what I see is that, really, I abandoned her way before she abandoned me. Because near the end of my drinking, I was hanging out in bars and sometimes not coming home, sleeping in my office because drinking with buddies and not really caring that she was home alone, not knowing what was happening. I abandoned her way before she abandoned me. Right? And when I realized that, when that came off the end of my pen, something just flipped inside of me. Right? Flipped from perspective-wise. I mean, just turned. Right? You know, it changed me because I realized, you know, I never intended to hurt her. Right? I never, it's not something I ever was, you know, I was just not thinking about her. Right? And when I realized how the things that I didn't like about Lori were the things that I find so objectionable about my own behavior, right? And I couldn't do anything different. Right? And that leads me into the fourth column. This is referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done. We resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Our own mistakes. That becomes an important phrase, especially with some people's inventories when they can't see what they've done. There's usually, even when somebody hasn't done anything, sometimes that's their mistake, right? Surrendering to being powerless and not doing what they were supposed to do, right? It says, where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened?